Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And if this is your first time watching or listening to the show, know that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, if you can't listen live, all of our shows, including this one, can be found at answers.network. And I really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. We all know that there are plenty of negative, slanted, and divisive information out there. But sharing my shows and other shows like this that focus on improved health, happiness, education, and success, that is just one powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world together, something our guest today is already doing. Now, our guest is Rizwan Burt, and he is a graduate of MIT and Stanford. He is a successful entrepreneur, video game pioneer, film producer, venture capitalist, and computer scientist. Now, I got to tell you that I get a lot of people that'll say to me, because I've had different careers, I don't know that I've had this many, so I'm really interested in learning more about Riz and how he's been able to handle these things, which, by the way, may I call you Riz?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, folks, let me tell you more. Riz is the best-selling author of The Simulation Hypotheses. An MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics agree we're in a video game. And he also has many other books. Now, the classic book, Autobiography of a Yogi, one of the most impactful spiritual books of the 20th century, it inspired millions to walk a spiritual path. But with that in mind, Riz asks more. He asks, what do 21st century spiritual aspirants steeped in technology and science think of these classic tales that you find in the autobiography, which includes information on gurus, swamis, and miracles in the Himalayas? Do these tales have relevance today? Well, in Wisdom of a Yogi, Riz brings out the lessons from the classic and he reinterprets them for the modern age, bringing the ancient lessons of karma, yoga, and meditation into the modern age of YouTube, video games, mobile phones, and social media. Whether you've never read Autobiography or have read it multiple times, Wisdom of a Yogi will help you enhance your spiritual practice in today's increasingly complex, cluttered, and connected world. Riz is currently a venture partner at Griffin Gaming Partners, one of the leading video game VC funds in the world, and has invested in many successful startups, including Discord, Theta Labs, Upland, and Tapjoy. His startups have created software used by Fortune 500 companies and have created video games played by millions, including games based on the TV shows Game of Thrones, Star Trek, The Walking Dead, Grimm, and Penny Dreadful. And I'm sure if anybody out there has watched television, you've seen one of those shows. Riz, welcome to Answers Network.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Well, what I'd love for you to do is to start out and give us a little bit of a background, because you have ventured into so many different areas. And I'd like you to share a little bit about what got you to that point to where you felt comfortable going into so many different areas, because I think that there's a lot of people out there that think that there's these limitations on us, that you learn one thing and you go do it for 50 years and you get a, you know, you get a little, party when you leave your business, but you've done anything but that. So share us a little bit more of your background.
Sure. Absolutely. So, you know, I guess it depends a little bit on your personality type, right? I'm a person that has many different interests. And so when people ask me, well, how is it that you ended up doing all these things? including, you know, being in the video game industry, being a software entrepreneur, an investor, and an author. And, you know, they say, well, maybe you don't get a lot of sleep. And I said, no, you know, I actually do get a lot of sleep because I like the dreaming state. And I've experimented with, you know, lucid dreaming and other, you know, spiritual practices in the dream state. But the key for me really is what I call the treasure hunt of life and the treasure hunt of your career. And I like to use the analogy of an Indiana Jones film. I'm sure some of your listeners have seen any of the old ones or the new movie that's about to come out. I think end of this month, actually. And, you know, in those movies, wouldn't it be nice if Indiana Jones at the beginning just got a map and it just said, yep, there it is. There's the Ark of the Covenant. You know, just go get it. Well, it might be interesting, but not to us, the audience, right? It would make for a very boring movie. And so the way that these films usually proceed, the way that adventures usually proceed, is that you get one clue. And with Indiana Jones, where does that clue lead him? Usually it leads him to the next clue. And where does that lead him to the next clue? And eventually there's a treasure, but perhaps the journey is a key part of the treasure all along. And so, you know, that's been my career, has been following the clues of whatever I've been interested in. And, you know, I wrote a book a few years back called Treasure Hunt, which was a little bit about this idea that synchronicities and coincidences and clues that we get in our dreams are all related, and they're all kind of like these clues in a treasure hunt. You know, I started off as a computer scientist. I studied computer science at MIT. All my friends were, you know, engineers and scientists, so generally very left-brained folks, right, who weren't into a lot of these spiritual things. You know, I started meditating, I'll have to admit, just because I thought, hey, this will help me out. It'll help me with my concentration, and maybe I can be a better programmer. Maybe I can be a more successful entrepreneur. You know, I wrote about some of my early experiences with my very first startup in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is actually where I am for the summer right now. You know, that was why I pursued the path. But in the end, I realized I had it backwards. You know, it's like the things that happen in our lives, what the sages refer to as samsara, right, the world of illusion or maya, are there to help us with our spiritual growth, right? The spiritual practices aren't there to help us with be more successful in the world, but although they can help, certainly from a physical, you know, point of view, and from the concentration point of view and stress point of view and all of those, but that there was something deeper going on. And so throughout my career, you know, as I started a video game company almost a decade ago now, where we had the number one downloaded game in the App Store. It was called Tap Fish at the time. It was quite successful, and we ended up selling that to a Japanese company. And then I became, you know, more interested in video games and how they work. And I became an investor in the video game industry. And, you know, there was a time probably about 7 years ago where I was visiting a startup that I had actually invested in that made a virtual reality ping pong game. So we put on this headset, and these headsets were bulky. You may have seen the Apple announcement of their new virtual and augmented reality headset called Vision Pro that just happened last week. But I mean, this is 7 years ago, so there were wires connecting this thing. It was coming down from the ceiling, so it was kind of uncomfortable. At the same time, the responsiveness of the ping pong game was so good that I actually, for a moment, you know, it fooled my brain into thinking that I was really playing an actual game of table tennis, so much so that at the end of the game, I tried to put the paddle down on the table and I tried to lean against the table, just like I might do at the end of an actual game. But of course, there was no table, right? And the controller fell to the floor and I almost fell over, and I realized, oh, our technology is getting to the point where it can fool us, you know, and eventually it'll get there. And the graphics weren't even that great back then. The graphics are much better today than they were. But we're getting to the point where we could immerse ourselves in a virtual world and fool ourselves. And that's where I really started to kind of bring together these two threads of my life, which was my my work, day jobs, if you will, which was as an entrepreneur, and then I became an investor. And then I've been kind of living a double life. I like to say it's kind of like Shirley MacLaine. You know, if you've ever read any of her classics where she was out, you know, doing her dancing gigs, and then she'd go visit a channeler at night.
Yeah.
When she was, you know, visiting Sweden or wherever. And so I had this kind of double life going on all this time. And, you know, I decided to think about how these things all fit together. And I realized that the video game metaphor was the key to bringing these things together, that the mystics have been telling us all along, that everything is an illusion and we are able to create illusions with our games. And so anyway, that's kind of where, how I got to where I am today. But, you know, in terms of your question, I really just followed the clues of the things that I was personally interested in. And that's the advice I would give to people. Don't hold back. If something interests you, go out, research it. Go to some meetups, right? Go and meet other people in that field. And eventually, when you do, you spend enough time in that field, you end up, you know, becoming someone who knows something about it. And that typically leads to perhaps the next stage of your career. I mean, I always knew that I would be a writer at some age. You know, if you had come to me in high school, I would have said, well, I know I'm going to be a software entrepreneur and then I'm going to be a writer. Now, I thought that was going to happen at the age of 28. But it didn't happen until I was like 48 in terms of actually becoming a full-time writer. But, you know, I think we have the storylines, right? Getting back to the idea of video game. And so I had this sense, and then I just followed the clues from there.
Well, I love that. And again, being a detective myself, the idea of researching everything makes so much sense that I get it. You know, with your book on the simulation hypotheses, this intrigues me so much, and I think it's because it's an area that I don't know that much about. But I know that Elon Musk has said that he believes that we're living in a simulated reality, or that if we're not, that we will eventually cease to exist if we don't. So pretending that I know nothing about the simulated hypotheses, which isn't far from the truth, share a little bit about what it is and how it relates to us.
Sure. So the simulation hypothesis is the idea that we live inside a high resolution, high fidelity, interactive computer simulation, or as I like to say, a video game. And what Elon Musk actually said, you know, back in 2016, he was at the Code Conference, and, you know, he said that 40 years ago, we had Pong. So it's funny how ping pong keeps coming up. So Pong was the first commercially available video game. Arcade game that was really popular. It was made by Atari in 1972 or 73, and it appeared, you know, at places everywhere. And he said, today we have interactive virtual reality. We have 3D massively multiplayer online games, or what are called MMORPGs. And he said, if you look at how the technology is improving, at some point it will get so good that we will be able to we will not be able to distinguish between physical and virtual reality, just like what happened to me when I was playing ping pong. So part of the reason why I wrote this book was I was projecting the 10 stages, the simulation book, of technology that would get us to the point where we could create something like the Matrix, right? And that's perhaps the best pop culture reference, or the most well-known pop culture reference. Not necessarily the best one. I'll tell you what I think is the best one in a minute, but the most well-known, which is, you know, Neo, Keanu Reeves, starts off thinking he's in reality, but he's actually in a computer simulation. Now, in that case, he is a player who exists outside of the game, and he has a character inside the game, which is, you know, what we call an avatar, which is a term that was, you know, brought down from the ancient Sanskrit. So you start to see the weird connections between video games and ancient Indian philosophy, even things like multiple lives in video games, right? There are all these little references to things that kind of touch on that. And so that's what I call the role-playing version of the simulation hypothesis. There's also the NPC version of the simulation hypothesis. And now what NPC stands for is non-player character, right? So if you think of the Matrix, there were those characters who had a player, and they had, you know, in this case, an interface into them. But there were those that were just programmed, or just AI, Agent Smith. Agent Smith was a program, and the Oracle, if you remember the Oracle, was another program. And then the Matrix sequels were full of these programs. And so in a video game, whenever you encounter a character that is not being controlled by a player, like suppose you're in a tavern, right? A lot of games are fantasy role-playing, like token games. You're in a tavern and there's a bartender, that's an NPC, it's a non-player character. And so the other version of the simulation hypothesis is that we are all NPCs. We are just code running on a computer program going. And then when the computer program ends, you know, we're done. And so that's part of what he was referring to when he talked about we would cease to exist when the simulation stops running. Or if we never run a simulation, our civilization will just end. But if we can run a simulation, we'll continue to exist in those simulations. And so there's what's called an ancestor simulation. An ancestor simulation, which is a term coined by a guy named Nick Bostrom, who's a professor at Oxford, is when you create a simulation of your ancestors. So if we create a game about the Roman Empire, right? That's, you could say they are our ancestors, right? And so the idea is that once a civilization gets to this point where they can create the Matrix, basically, and lots of simulations like the Matrix, then they will create lots of them. And this is the point that Professor Bostrom at Oxford put forward. And once they do that, there's going to be lots of simulated worlds, but there's only one physical world. So if you're in a world, which one are you more likely in? There's 99 million of these, and there's one of these, right? So statistically, what are you more likely, a simulated being or a physical being? Well, statistically, you're more likely to be that. And so that was a paper he wrote back in 2003 that got people like Elon Musk, and that's what led Elon Musk to say at the end of that particular clip, the chances that we are not in a simulation, the chances that we are in what's called base reality is one in billions. Right. And so that's, I think, you know, how that clip got circulated and how Elon Musk has gotten associated with this idea that we live inside a video game.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that we're living in a simulated universe right now with what we're doing right now?
Well, if you think about it, right now, we're not really talking to each other, right? I am talking to my computer.
Right.
You are talking to your computer. And the bits are being sent over as information. And then your voice is being rendered on my computer. And similarly, the people aren't really listening to us, the listeners, right? They're on their computers or mobile phones or wherever they have, or radios, wherever they happen to be. And so in a sense, we are already having a virtual conversation. I mean, how do you know this is what I look like, right? Zoom and others actually have a new feature called avatar, where you choose a different avatar. Right. And you could turn it into a rabbit and it would try to mimic your movements. Right. And so, you know, the conclusion that I came to, and, you know, the full title of that book of Simulation Hypothesis is, the subtitle is, an MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics all agree we are in a video game. And there's a reason I put all of those in that somewhat long, you know, and awkward subtitle. And I've talked about AI now, where if AI gets to the point where it thinks it's conscious, we'll have virtual worlds, what's called the metaverse, with lots of AIs in there. They'll be like NPCs. And, you know, I won't get into details on quantum physics, but the more you look into physics, the more you realize that there is no such thing as the material world, right? They look for this thing called the material world, and when they look, they're like, well, there's molecules, but they're really just these kind of small things called atoms, and they're pretty far apart. And then when you get in the atoms, it's 99% open space. And then when you get into the nucleus, you say, okay, well, at least there's something. But then, you know, you go in there, and what happened is there was a physicist named John Wheeler, and he was one of the giants of physics in the 20th century, and he worked with people like Einstein and Niels Bohr. He was at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, and he came up with this phrase called it from bit. And he said that as he looked for that fundamental thing, he came to the conclusion that that fundamental thing was just information. It's just bits. So if there's an it, it consists of a whole bunch of things called particles, which don't really exist. They exist only by way of their answers to a set of yes, no questions, which is basically what a bit is. It's a yes, no question. A bit is a zero or a one. It's like the smallest piece of information. And so, you know, even the physicists are coming to the conclusion that there is no such thing as a physical world. It's built on information. And that's what a video game is. That's what a computer rendering is. It's information that gets rendered. Just like my avatar is being rendered on your screen. Now, if we step back and say, perhaps this whole thing, like this room behind me, just like the virtual background in Zoom, right? I mean, they've gotten so good with virtual backgrounds that you don't know if you're looking at an actual background or not. But that the whole physical world is being rendered. And you know, this is why there's an interesting transition here to Yogananda, an autobiography of a yogi. And so there's one quote from Yogananda that always stuck with me. And It says, you know, if it must be so, let man learn from physical science the truth that there is no such thing as a material universe. Its warp and woof is Maya, and its mirages of reality break down under analysis. So it's interesting that, you know, the ancient yogis came to this conclusion long ago, and we're just now catching up to it with modern science. And of course, you know, quantum physics was relatively new at the time when Yogananda, he came over over 100 years ago in 1920 from India to Boston and eventually ended up in LA. And he wrote the book in 1945, well, he wrote it in the decade before 1945, yeah. In Encinitas, not far from where you are, where they have a hermitage now. And so that's where the transition was between this idea of a reality that's not quite real. And so back to your question, do I think we live in a simulated universe? I think based upon everything I've looked into, including understanding the computer science myself as a computer scientist, including what the physicists have told us, right? I'm not a physicist, so I go by their interpretations and what Yogananda and other mystics have been telling us for ages. And it turns out this is not true, not just with the Eastern religions, but this is true within the Judeo-Christian religions as well, that I think it's more likely than not that we are in an illusory world that consists of information that gets rendered for us, like an interactive computer video game.
Well, I mean, doesn't that go against like the, you know, the Newtonian model, you know, that physics, you know, was a study of physical objects and that everything was reduced to particles, you know, so, you know, essentially, yes, you're saying that, I guess, Newton was wrong.
Well, I think physics is saying that Newton was wrong in the sense that, Newtonian physics breaks down, and that's what the physicists are saying. And so John Wheeler, who I mentioned earlier, the scientist from Princeton, he said in his life, physics went through three phases. Okay, and he died, I think, in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s. But so he was there for a lot of these changes, and he studied directly with these guys. And he said when he was younger, everyone thought that everything in the world was a particle, right? So a solid particle, and that's Newtonian physics. He goes, then we physicists decided that's not true. So everything is a field, right? It's like a quantum field of probabilities, or a field like a magnetic field, and that was the only reality. That this part. So the particle model got kind of pushed aside, you know, over 100 years, almost 100 years ago. And then he said, in the third phase, he realized everything was just information. And so that which we think is physical is actually information. And so that's why I think, you know, and it's, you don't have to take my word for it, but, you know, Newtonian physics works at a macro level. But when you start to look at what is the underlying piece of the material world, you just can't find it.
Well, how close do you think we are from building our own artificial world that is as realistic as the Matrix or more? And if it's really achievable, do we do it?
Well, so I think human history has taught us that if something is achievable, it probably will happen, whether it should or not.
It should or not, that's my point.
Question, right? And I've spent a lot of time, reading about and investigating the Manhattan Project, right? There's a great movie and book called Day One. Of course, there's a new movie coming out called Oppenheimer from Christopher Nolan here this summer. But in my opinion, the best kind of representation of that project is Day One, the movie or the book, which goes into a lot of detail. So that's a separate question. Now, today there's a lot of talk of the singularity. You've probably heard that term. Yep. It's very popular in Silicon Valley. And the singularity is generally used to refer to a point at which technological advancement will go so fast that everything will be different. And it's a term from physics. If you've ever seen the old physics diagrams, they borrowed a term from mathematics where you have a line and it just goes up like that, asymptotically goes to infinity, and that's what happens when you get near a black hole. And so the idea is at some point technology just advances asymptotically, and then particularly around AI and superintelligence, right? So that's where this term is usually applied. It actually was coined by a science fiction writer and computer scientist, Werner Vinge, who wrote a lot of great science fiction books on these topics. I don't think any of them have made it into movies, though. But so, you know, Elon Musk and others have just signed, you know, these petitions saying we should stop the research on AI because it's possible that the AI will become super conscious or super intelligent and that it will take over the Earth, you know, kind of a Terminator-like scenario. But there's also other kinds of technological singularities. And I believe what I call the simulation point, which is exactly this point that you're asking me about, which is the point at which we can create matrix-like realities that are indistinguishable from physical reality. And each of them has AI beings as well as player characters, you know, within these things. So in those stages, we're at about 4 or 5 out of the 10 stages that I laid out. But we're moving rapidly towards them. And so it's very possible that we'll get there. My original estimate was about 100 years, right? But if you think of an advanced civilization, one that's, you know, let's say it's 1,000 years ahead of us, right? So they discovered computers 1,000 years ago. We only started doing this 100 years ago. And those were like the big ENIAC, right? The personal computers, not even that. Maybe 40, 50 years old, like Elon Musk was saying with video games. So if they're 1,000 years ahead of us, they've probably already gotten there, right? Which means they're already, they've already created lots and lots of these simulated worlds, right? And so what Bostrom from Oxford said is there's a couple of possibilities. One is that they never get to that point. No technological civilization ever gets to that point. Now that's unlikely because I think we're already on the way there ourselves. And if it, even if it takes us 100 years, that's nothing in cosmic time. It's like a blink of an eye. So we'll probably get there. And this includes brain-computer interfaces where you send the information into the brain. And if you look at Apple's Vision Pro headset, which just came out or was announced last week, you know, they're already looking at where your eyes go and they're trying to read. They're not actually reading your brain signals, but they're doing something very close to it. And it almost looks like mind reading because you look over here and then it suddenly highlights that part of the screen. Now you combine that with what Elon Musk is doing at Neuralink, where, you know, they're actually placing a chip, which is called invasive brain computer interfaces. Now, personally, I don't think you need to be invasive to read the brain because you have electrical signals already. And there are plenty of, you know, headsets that are that can read those electrical signals without being invasive. And there was a video of Elon Musk where they taught a monkey to play a video game with the joystick, and they give him a reward every time he played correctly. And then they kept giving him the reward, but they disconnected the joystick and they were just reading his brain signals. And he was able to play the game. And guess what the game was? It was Pong, the original game, right? Which is why it's strange how ping pong keeps coming up, as I said, because it was a very simple game. And so I think we'll get there to that technological point. Now, you know, there's a lot of implications of this. Right? There's the AI implications, but there's also implications that if you can feel like you just went to India and you just experienced the sights and smells and sounds, but you didn't have the, you know, the digestive issues you might we might get when we go to that part of the world. Would you rather do that than go out? Would you rather experience? So there's a lot of great science fiction on this. So that's a bigger question. Should we get there or not? The point is, though, people often ask me, why would we be in a simulation? Why would we run a simulation? And I say, well, why do we play video games? Right. Now, I think our generation, you know, video games were introduced, you know, when I was a kid and I played Atari, and these were simple games, you know, Pac-Man, Space Invaders, Donkey Kong. They're nothing like the games we have today, which are fully rendered three-dimensional worlds. I watch my nephews play the video games today and they're like almost photorealistic. I mean, if you watch a movie like Blade Runner or Star Wars or the movie theater, the recent ones, it's hard to tell which elements are CGI and which are physical. And they're only projecting at a 2K resolution. We already have monitors at a 4K resolution and above. So it's not a resolution problem anymore, right? It's a rendering problem. So, you know, we're going to get to that point. So the reason we play video games is, one, to have experiences that we can't have outside of the game, right? I mean, I can't fly on the dragon in this reality, whether it's physical or not, that's a separate question. But I can do it in a virtual, quote unquote, virtual reality. And then the other reason we run simulations is to see what will happen. Right. So we might do a simulation of a virus, right? look at all these simulations, whether they were correct or not, of how, you know, COVID might spread, et cetera, but, or we might do a simulation of the weather. So we run these simulations, and there's a process that there's a physicist turned computer scientist named Stephen Wolfram, who lives there in LA, who defined a term called computationally irreducible. And he says the only way to know what will happen if a process is computationally irreducible is you have to run it. So if you want to know what's going to happen at step 5 million or year 5 million, you have to run all the steps before that. And so when we run simulations, we run not just one, we run multiple simulations, right? And then we change the variables. And you know, this would get us into a whole nother topic, which is the topic of my second simulation book called The Simulated Multiverse, which was Philip K. Dick had a great speech in 1977 in Metz, France, the sci-fi writer, where he said, we are living in a computer programmed reality. And the only clue we have is when some variable is changed, some alteration occurs in our reality. We would have the sense of reliving the same moment again and again, having deja vu. So that takes us in a weird place, which is not only running one simulation, but running multiple simulations. It's possible that you and I have already met. You may have seen the movie, The Man in the High Castle, or the series that came out on Amazon, which was based on Philip K. Dick's Hugo Award-winning novel from 1960, where there was a timeline where the Germany and Japan, the Axis powers, won World War II. He came to believe that was a real timeline that actually happened, and that all the memories from that timeline came flooding. I interviewed his wife as part of my research for the book, and he said we were reset. And so you know, I think it's inevitable that we will run these simulations. But if we back up now and say, okay, well, why would we be in a simulation? For the same reason, perhaps the suffering, the pain, and the pleasure that we have in this physical world is something that doesn't exist in the spiritual world, you know, outside of this particular reality. So that's, you know, perhaps a longer answer to your question.
No, I like that. And it is one of the thoughts that I had is that if we are, or if we were to do that, the greatest benefit would be to be able to pick and choose which parts we continue with. So, you know, to remove suffering, to enhance joy, you know, to be able to do things like that. If we can do that, sort of like a genetic alteration of taking out the bad and leaving in the good. Yeah, I would like that. We're going to take a break. So for everybody out there, if you know somebody that would be interested in this, we're going to take a break. We'll be about a minute. If you want to learn more about AI, or we're also going to talk about Wisdom of a Yogi, which really brings the autobiography of a yogi, brings all of that information to today to see how would that work today. So if you want to hear more, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we are back. We are talking about all kinds of things as it relates to the future. We're talking about AI, but I'd like to go a little bit deeper. We're talking with Riz Virk and your book, Wisdom of a Yogi. At what level did you, as you were reading Autobiography of a Yogi for, I don't know, you know, how many times, at what point did you get the idea you know what, let me bring this up to date. Let me touch on some of the things to show people that a lot of these things, they still work today in the 21st century.
Yeah. So, you know, I first read Autobiography of a Yogi back in the 1990s, and then I would read it every few years. And, you know, it's a deeply inspirational book. It was voted one of the top 100 spiritual books of the 20th century and certainly one of the best selling. And, you know, Yogananda was called the first modern guru because, you know, he came in the 1920s and he wasn't afraid to update the methods of teaching yoga for the West. And he spent most of his adult life in America. But a lot of the stories that he tells are stories that took place in India during his childhood. And so I would reread this every few years. And like many of your listeners, I'm sure I found the book quite inspirational. And, you know, there were stories of strange entities and swamis living in the Himalayas who lived for hundreds of years. And you have people levitating and you have people appearing and disappearing. And, you know, I was always intrigued. Yogananda himself collected these stories throughout his life. And it's pretty amazing that he actually remembered all of them. In fact, I would say that his prodigy as somebody who would, like, anytime he heard of a swami or guru where he grew up in Calcutta, he would, like, make a beeline there and go get to know them. So, you know, he would see these things firsthand in some cases or hear about them from others. That was part of his life story, right? Which gets back to what we're talking about is sometimes we have a story for ourselves that we may or may not be aware of. We also choose our character, like you might, when I was a kid, we used to play Dungeons and Dragons, and you would say, okay, I'm going to be, you know, an elf, and I'm going to be a wizard, and you roll the dice, and you've got some people have higher charisma, and some people have lower, and some have more physical strength, and some don't, like in the Autobiography of a Yogi, there's a story of the Tiger Swami, which we can talk about in a little while, who actually would physically battle tigers, Bengal tigers with his bare hands. So it's always been a favorite of mine. But it one of the lessons that I bring about in this book, Wisdom of a Yogi, is that sometimes life gives you a task. There's a task that's part of your story, whether you're aware of it or not. And I talked about our storyline that we may be aware of the general story. But, you know, I went through some physical health issues a few years back. And during that time, you know, I was sitting on the couch and I focused on my writing. And I decided to just write a few articles about I reread Yogananda's book for like the nth time. And I said, well, what else can I read? And I looked around for other books that were like this because they were so much fun to read. And I wrote a few blog articles about it. And then just at the end of that time period, sometimes I like to say the universe gives us an invitation, right? Whether we're expecting it or not. And that invitation opens up a door. It's like a big clue, right? So I talked about clues at the beginning of this podcast. There are little clues, which are like little hunches, feelings of deja vu that says, maybe this is something I want to explore. And then there are the big clues, right? In this case, I actually got an invitation from HarperCollins in India. And they said, hey, you know, it's the 75th anniversary of the publishing of Autobiography of a Yogi. And we'd like to update the book and write it so that, you know, younger readers in particular, but just modern people in general can relate better to these stories. And we'd like you to write it. And I was sort of scratching my head and I said, really? You want me to write it? Like, I'm not a Swami. I'm not a renunciate. I'm not even a Hindu, right? I was born in Pakistan and grew up as a Muslim, but I spent a lot of time studying the Hindu and the Buddhist traditions just because I'm intrigued by the mystical side of these. I'm a computer scientist. I spend my time and my whole career, you know, in business where people are trying to make money. So it's a whole different world. They said, no, we think you're the right person because of, you know, this analogy that you've drawn between the Eastern mystical traditions and video games and computer technology. And so, you know, today when we're dealing with social media, we're dealing with streaming, we're dealing with YouTube, we're dealing with all these things. And you know, youngsters today spend more time in video games than you know, just about any other activity, even than TV, watching TV series, right? If you look at the number of hours. And so I took it upon myself. I had that feeling. And so sometimes people say to me, how do I know when something is a clue that I should follow? And I say, well, sometimes clues designate direction. It's something you're intrigued about, but not timing. A different time. Other times they indicate timing and not direction. But in this case, it was both, right? There was a direction and a timing, and I had a feeling in my body. It was like an electrical feeling that said, oh, this is something you have to do as part of your task in this life. And so I accepted the quest. So if you ever play video games today, video games consist of a series of quests and achievements. And as your character, you see the different quests and you say, okay, I accept that quest. And perhaps we're doing this already in the spiritual world. And sometimes we have difficulties in our lives, which I like to think of as turning up the difficulty level in a game, right? Mm-hmm. Some people have it easy. It seems like everything's easy. But sometimes we have physical problems, we have financial problems, we have relationship problems, right? And things can seem really difficult. And you think of those, you can think of those as this kind of more difficult part of your quest, but it's a part of your quest. So in this case, my setbacks, which included, you know, some pretty serious surgery, was a big setback for me in my professional career in that I was, you know, could no longer start a company, but I decided to focus in on my writing, which was the second part of my career that I was not paying enough attention to, right? And so it was during that time when I started to refocus my attention on this other part of my life that I got this invitation, and that's how I ended up writing this book, which was released in India initially, and then now this June it's being released here in the U.S. as well.
Well,
In fact, today is release day, June 12th. So,
exactly.
It's released today.
Yes, which is perfect. One of the things that I liked so much in the book itself is you go into lessons. I'm big on lessons. And in fact, I was just having a conversation with my girlfriend. We were talking about, and I told the story of, the Chinese man in the village, where something happens and his his horse runs away, and all the villagers, you probably know this, and all the villagers are like, oh, that's so terrible. He goes, maybe good, maybe bad, and as it goes through, then the horse comes back with three other horses, and so they went, oh, that's so wonderful. He goes, maybe good, maybe bad, and then his son's riding one of the horses and he breaks his leg. Oh, that's terrible. Well, maybe good, maybe bad. And then, the army comes into town and takes all of the boys over the age of 15, except his, because he has a broken leg. So it's this thing of maybe good, maybe bad. I love lessons. And that's what we were talking about over the weekend is that, we learn from everything. And it might have been a difficult experience. It might have been a very positive experience. I know you have 14 lessons that you talk about in the book. Share a couple of the lessons, and we've got about 6 minutes left, but I'd love for people to get an idea of the type of lessons that they're going to get when they pick up the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So, there's a bunch of different lessons, and each of them are based on stories from Autobiography of a Yogi, and sometimes multiple stories. And then I pair those with stories from the modern world, stories from my life and my career, but also from professors and entrepreneurs and students and Hollywood producers and other people that I interviewed, as part of this. And so, one of the first lessons is you don't have to go to the Himalayas, right? And so Yogananda spent a big part of his youth trying to run away from home. He knew he had to be a Swami, so he assumed he had to run away to the Himalayas to find a guru. And of course, each of those was thwarted because he was still a kid. His parents didn't want him to go. His older brother would chase him across the railroads of northern India to get him back. But the funny thing is, when he finally found his guru, he ended up being only a few miles away from where he lived in Calcutta. And so he thought he had to go to the Himalayas, and he had this vision of himself as a wandering Swami. Now, not only did he not have to go to the Himalayas, but he also did become a wandering Swami. It just wasn't where he thought. He became a wandering Swami in the United States of America. He probably put on more miles than any previous Swami, given all the railroads were new at the time. And there are many modern instances. Steve Jobs, for example, went all the way to India, and there he saw a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi in his room that he was staying in, and he brought it back, and then he read it every few years. And when he died, it was according to many people around him, it was the only book on his iPad. And at his funeral, according to the CEO of Salesforce.com, everybody received a little brown box, and in that box, turns out, was a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi. And so it turns out, you know, even Steve Jobs, you know, he went all the way there, but he found things closer to home. And so that's one of the lessons that I think is important. You know, another lesson is the lesson of the tiger Swami that I mentioned earlier, who spent the first part of his life fighting tigers, and he got fame and fortune, and, you know, he got lots of rewards fighting his outer tigers, right? And I like to say there's a karmic lesson there, that sometimes we are drawn to these external battles. Like, I spent a lot of time in the business world fighting the battles of startups, which are about to die any minute. And so you basically think your whole life is like a battle if you run a startup. But then, you know, he was given the message that he needs to start focusing on his inner tigers, the tigers of ignorance, you know, of all these different mental, you know, types of what they call vrittis, which are like whirlpools of desire and thought. And he didn't do that. He decided to keep fighting tigers. And he came across a particularly ferocious Bengal tiger that ended up mauling him. And he spent 6 months just recovering, you know, from this. And after that point, he no longer had the desire to go out and fight physical tigers, but he turned his attention to becoming a Swami and taming his inner thoughts and his inner desires. And he became the Tiger Swami. And so his lesson to Yogananda was, fight your inner tigers as well as your outer tigers. My interpretation of that, though, is that the outer tigers were an important part. He would never have started fighting his inner tigers if he didn't have that experience. And then the particular, you know, the mauling that he had, which knocked him out for 6 months, physically cut him up, was the course correction. He was fighting his outer tigers for too long. And so we all have these karmic tendencies and these things that we are attracted to that nobody else would necessarily want to do. They are related to us, right? I mean, who else actually wants to go out and fight tigers? This is a very unique to this particular individual. So fight your outer tigers, but then your inner tigers are just as important. So, you know, get through that. And the same thing happened to me. I had literally had heart surgery where they cut off my body, and I spent 6 months unable to do anything. And that's when I realized that I was spending all my energy fighting my outer tigers. And whenever I would recover, I'd try to jump back into the business world. And then I would start to feel bad again, and I'd end up on the couch again for a month. And so I realized, oh, this is the message of this illness and this particular, you know, in my case, it was a mauling by medical science, not by tigers, but it had pretty much the same effect, which is, okay, I need to focus in on a different part of my life. It was a course correction. So those are a couple of the lessons. Another one is about, what is the definition of yoga, right? We think of yoga as being the physical postures or the asanas, but really the definition of yoga is that it is the stilling of the vrittis, which are these whirlpools of thought and desire. Right. So any practice that stills this storm, it's like a snow globe. If you think of a snow globe and you shake it up, you can't see what's inside. But if you let them all settle, mm-hmm. you can clearly see what's inside, and whoever's inside can see out. We are like in the middle of our own little snow globe. And if we are able to find any practice of yoga, whatever that is, that calms these storms of what I call whirlpools of desire and thought in the rivers of consciousness, then that's important that we find a routine to do that. So those are some of the lessons that are there.
Well, I absolutely love that. And under the category touching me emotionally, I didn't know that you had gone through that that particular thing. I'm within 3 weeks as far as having gotten out of the hospital for that. And I'd love to maybe chat with you sometimes, because I do find myself going into some interesting thoughts that I didn't have before having that experience. So wouldn't mind having a chat with you off the air sometime about that.
Absolutely.
I really want to thank you. And on so many levels, one is, and for everybody out there, these books make you think. And to me, in this day and age, that is one of the greatest gifts that anyone can give you, is to give you the gift of making you think. And I know that there might be other forces out there trying to tell you to do just the opposite, but let me tell you, this is a gift. If you get the opportunity, please get these books, or any book that makes you think. because you will be rewarded as well as all of us. And Riz, thank you so much, because I think you are rewarding all of us with the work that you're doing in helping, I think, this next generation be able to make better decisions, to be able to think about how they're going to take us into this next realm that we don't know what it is yet. But by you helping them think, I think it's going to take us in a positive path. So again, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on and letting me share my story.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be with us next week. We're going to continue to focus on bringing you people that are going to help you make better decisions in your life, to be more grateful, to be able to show the appreciation for the people around you that are helping you, and live a better, happier, healthier life. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.